Trigger warning, sexual assault. The following episode may contain graphic discussions of sexual assault, child sexual abuse, murder, or rape, which some listeners may find disturbing. It is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Please listen with care. Hi, everyone. I'm Sherry Kearney, and this is Roar with Sherry, all things justice for women and survivors. I've spent over 30 years surviving child sexual abuse, rape, incest, campus sexual assault. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's this. Our greatest gift can be found in our greatest trauma. Our trauma, our pain, cuts through to our inner core and reveals the magic within. And that once survivors find their voice, begin their healing journey, and come out the other side, there is no stopping us. That from trauma comes resilience and healing. You are fearless, brave, strong, courageous, magnificent, and I love you. I want this to be a podcast that's real, unpolished, gritty, honest, and reflects both the pain and purpose that comes from being a survivor. We will always ask, what happened to you? What have you experienced? What have you lived through? What have you survived? What is your story? And what must be done to bring you healing, closure, and yes, justice? The purpose of this podcast is raw emotion, our stories, inspiration, perspiration, and ultimately power through justice for survivors. Each episode will include conversations with guests who inspire me, offer insight into the law, help survivors find justice, victim stories, and life-changing transformations. People who are teaching me, challenging me, and inspiring me to move forward. I'll also have direct conversations with you about what I'm learning from survivors and experts that may help you break silence, speak out, find your purpose, seek and receive justice. So we'll do some episodes dedicated to answering your questions. You are not alone. This is your safe home for open, honest, provocative conversations about the dark secrets 81% of us have experienced, but don't talk about. You do not have to walk this path of life by yourself. You are not alone. We are here, and we will roar as one. All things justice for women and survivors with you. I'm Sherry Kearney. Welcome.
Do you have a little baby sister?
No, I got a baby.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sherry Kearney, and this is Roar with Sherry, All Things Justice for Women and Survivors. You've just heard the horrifying child on the 911 call. In this episode, I'm talking with Nisha Himes, an African-American victim of domestic violence, who says it's been 9 years since I was last assaulted in a domestic violence nightmare. She said it was the most violent and vicious attack that she had experienced from her perpetrator. She did escape the abusive relationships and left the white man that was battering her. Boxing, she says, has been very instrumental in my journey as a survivor. She shares the journey started when she wanted to learn to defend herself. It wasn't long after leaving that abusive relationship that Nisha knew, I never want to feel like I can't defend myself again. Nisha founded the nonprofit GROW, G-R-O-W, to help girls of color improve self-esteem, their ability to be successful, and their destiny. Nisha has a quiet way of speaking the truth and drawing the truth out of listeners. She even got me to disclose, actually for the first time, that I too had been a victim of domestic abuse in a previous relationship. Come sit and join the conversation with me and Nisha. Welcome to All Things Justice for Women and Children, and roar with us. Help me welcome this heroic woman, Nisha Himes. Welcome, Nisha.
Hello, Sherry. How are you?
I'm good. It's a privilege to have you. So I've been seeing the work that you're doing in your community, and it's really important. Can you tell us a little bit more of what got you started doing the work that you're doing? Give us a little bit of your own story.
Sure. So I am a survivor of domestic violence. I was in a very toxic and abusive relationship for about 5 years.
Wow. Long time.
Long time. And after leaving that relationship for the last time, I still dealt with some after effects of trying to get away from the relationship for good, I should say. So in that relationship, the first year, knowing what I know now as an advocate and just doing the work that I do, I know that there were a lot of red flags that I either didn't recognize were red flags or chose to ignore, just making excuses of it. Just writing it off as me being dramatic or too sensitive or something along those lines. And I just look past some things that, again, knowing what I know now, I know that those were key factors.
Okay, so tell us some of the red flags, because I relate to you. I was in a relationship that, because I come from such a dysfunctional, crazy family, a lot of drama, a lot of throwing things and loud fighting and threats seemed normal to me and seemed like what love is. And it took a friend of mine, which I'll talk about later, to really say to me, you know, Sherry, you got to get out of this relationship. You got to move out. You got to go to therapy if you want to stay, but this cannot go on. She saved my life. So tell me a little bit about what your life was like, because there's so many survivors out there, both men and women, both BIOP, which is biracial, Native American, people of color, Latinx, that seem to have even more struggles identifying domestic violence, because many of us are already in oppressed communities.
Right.
We're either abused children, or we come from poverty, or we come from fighting parents, alcoholism, violence in our house. So it's hard when you're in an adult relationship to really recognize those red flags. It feels normal. So could you tell me a little bit more detail, like how it started, when you recognized it, what were the flags that you should have or might see or can tell the rest of us to see? So tell me a little bit more in depth about your story for a few minutes here.
Okay, sure. And just wanted to point out something you said that was really impactful, just how it affects everyone. So it doesn't matter if you're a woman, a man, a child, an adult, Black, white, in the LGBTQ plus community, it literally affects us all. So as far as myself, I grew up in a household with three sisters. My parents were married until I was about 17, but I didn't grow up in a household with fighting and I didn't see dysfunction, you know?
You grew up in a normal household, unlike most of the rest of us.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, good for you. Yeah. And how was your community? Normal, middle class, wealthy?
Suburban, middle class. Community. And I know that that isn't always a precursor to like what's going on inside homes. But, you know, my parents eventually wound up divorcing when I was a teenager, but I didn't grow up seeing abuse, you know? So while they split because of their own differences, like physical abuse and all this stuff that I endured later, I didn't grow up seeing that. So that's another reason that made it hard for me to accept that this was abuse, because, and it's like works both ways. If you grow up in an abuse toxicity, you become used to functioning in dysfunction. And then when you don't grow up in households like that, you just, you're even you're still hard on yourself because you're like, I didn't see this growing up, so why am I accepting it?
Or you're looking at it and you don't know what it is. Like when you're an abused child and you get to be an adult, part of you figures out this is wrong, you didn't deserve it. Not every family acts like this. But if you come from a normal, you know, middle class suburban family, whether you're white, biracial, Native American, African American, LGBTQ, as you said, I think it gets really hard to recognize it because you don't know what it looks like. So that's why I wanted to ask how you grew up, because we are on polar opposites, but we both had trouble recognizing it.
And it goes to show, again, it affects us all. It sneaks up some of the signs that I know now. So he was very charming in the beginning. We hit it off right away. We were introduced by a mutual friend. She's actually his sister, and she and I used to work together, and we hit it off, you know. And when I met him, I had gotten out of a relationship maybe 6 months or so prior. So I was still kind of in that vulnerable place, but getting that place where you want to venture out and start possibly dating again and things like that. So he told jokes, we laughed, we could talk for hours. And eventually it came about that there were some insecurities that he had as it relates to my ex. So the relationship that I had ended prior to meeting this person, it was with my child's father. So he just had some insecurities as it related to us still having to communicate because we had a child.
Okay, so we're calling it insecurities, which kind of minimizes. There's a difference between being insecure and being crazy and abusive and angry. So
it didn't start off crazy.
Tell me, so when you say insecurities, what do you mean? Like he was jealous? He wanted to know how long you talk? Give me some examples, because I want our listeners to understand that this escalates in stages. It doesn't start out always as yelling, screaming, hitting, craziness. It starts out with curiosity, nagging, looking at your phone, looking at your text, tracking where you are. So tell me how these insecurities manifested.
So about 2 months into us talking or dating, we hadn't yet made anything official yet. Found out that he went through my phone and he saw this between myself and my ex that he didn't. So from there, he began to do things like, you know, who are you talking to? Were you talking to him? Why didn't you answer the phone when I called? If I didn't answer the phone in one or two rings as opposed to four or five rings, then it was, who was on the other line? Did you have somebody over? So I definitely agree that, you know, sometimes we say insecurities and it minimizes things, but I'll just say that it didn't start off crazy. It didn't start off with him being controlling and manipulative and isolation. It was such small little things, little nuggets that I didn't pick up on. And that's the thing about domestic violence. It just gradually increases. So I wrote it off as, okay, he's a bit insecure because he saw those messages in my phone and now he can't trust me. So I started shouldering the weight of why he was quote unquote insecure and then making excuses were the things that started happening as a result. So here I am, I'm a single, well, I'm a mom. I don't have men around my children. I'm not in a relationship with my children's father. I don't have men around them. So my day consisted of going to work, coming home, doing the mom thing, you know, school, homework with the kids, getting them dinner, ready for bed. And then if I wanted to have company, my boyfriend at that time, he could come over. But if I was too tired for him to come over, or if I said, okay, come over at 9:30 instead of 9 o'clock, you know, I need more time to get the kids in the bed. It was more like, okay, what's going on? Why was it okay for me to come over 9 o'clock last week, but this time it's not okay.
Right. Like, are you seeing some secret lover between 9 and 9:30, getting your kids to bed, packing their lunches, getting ready for work in a half hour. But did you ever feel like, I felt like it was my fault. I felt like I needed to change my behavior somehow, but no matter what behavioral changes I made, It only escalated.
Yes. I thought I had to be more or be less, depending on how you look.
Yes.
So I thought I had to be more willing to communicate. I thought I had to share more. So, okay, I'm going to the grocery store when I get off work, and then I'm going to get home, and then I'm going to feed the kids dinner, and then I'm going to, you know, make sure they get in a bath, and then I'm going to get them in the bed. And then I thought if I overshared, then he could never say that I was keeping anything from him. And then I thought I had to be less mouthy, if you will. So, you know, I'm from New Jersey, and I'm myself a very independent woman. And when he would say things or question me on some things, I would talk back, like, you know.
Like, give me an example of being mouthy, because sometimes it's just having a voice.
Right.
Like, sometimes it just felt like I was speaking up for myself, but it was experienced as being a mouthy bitch.
Right. So,
like, what was mouthy for you? Because when I get mouthy, get out of town.
And
that wasn't
really
mouthy what I was doing.
Right. It's not really mouthy. You know, it was like, I mean, I know mouthy, right?
So what is mouthy? What's real mouthy?
Right.
Give me an example of real mouthy and what you in fact said.
Okay. So me mouthy now, like, you know, I mean, who do you think you're talking to? You know, like, I don't have to explain myself to you. Back then, as soon as you get in the door, like, and I would say, well, why do I have to do that? Like, why do I need to call you since you're not my dad? You know, and then it's, oh, hiding something, you don't want to talk to me, you want to keep secrets. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? So I know I thought that was me, like, standing up for myself. And, you know, so.
And did you ever experience it? Like in the beginning, I was flattered by it. This person cares about me. They want to know what I'm doing. They're showing a tremendous interest. They love me. I thought it was a sign of love. Can you address that misnomer?
Yes. So that's when you get into a relationship, and particularly after you've gotten out of one recently that didn't work out, and we all want affection. We all want to feel love. So that's another thing I would do. Write it off like, he just really cares about me. Mm-hmm. You know, he read those messages in my phone, and looking back, they weren't even crazy or anything like that. And I made him not trust me. You know, he wants to spend his time with me because he likes me. So then when I'm canceling going out with my friends, I'm canceling performing at open mics, I'm canceling, you know, visiting, you know, my family or whatever I'm doing just so I can spend time with him. Because as he would say it, all I do is work and have my kids. So any other time outside of that is minimal. And he felt like it should be spent with him. And it was just put in a way like, I already don't get to see you. All you do is work. All you do is, you know, be with the kids. So when can I get some free time? So I started adjusting my world to fit his idea of what quality time, what enough time was, to the point where I found myself isolating myself from things I love to do. I like to go out with my girlfriends. I like to go to the local, you know, spoken word events. I like to do different things like that. And it was just that I couldn't do it anymore. And just to
this kind of isolates you, like most, right. I think most domestic violence perpetrators are misogynists. And I always say the men who hate women and the women who love them. So one of the problems with this is it starts to isolate you, because you start to want to be better for them. You want to avoid conflict. You stop seeing your friends. You stop talking to your family.
Right.
How does that play into the picture? Because women need to know, is that a red flag?
That is a red flag. If you find yourself isolated and so gradual, if you find yourself putting aside the things that you love to do, if you find yourself, all of your free time is being monopolized by this person, and it gets to a point where you can't even be, well, I don't know if you see my husband trying to crawl and not be in the camera.
I saw somebody go in, but I didn't know if it was your sister or your husband.
Oh, my husband.
Or your ex saying, don't talk about me like that. The ghost of Christmas past.
But, you know, if you find yourself where it's just like, you can't even be you anymore. You are shrinking to make this person feel whole. That is a red flag, you know? So It's just crazy how it works. I do get social media.
You're right. The group. See, what I'm seeing now from you that I didn't see in my own life, you just taught me something. It's just like on child sexual abuse or sexual violence, there's a grooming process.
Yes.
You were being groomed, and we don't understand what grooming means for domestic violence. Can you explain that a little bit? Like, did your children live with you? How did this affect? And it sounds to me, how did he groom you? And when did he finally get past grooming into action?
Okay. So I did mean to mention earlier, so this is not my kid's dad. So just to say, I didn't even have children with this guy. This is somebody I dated after the relationship ended with my children's father. And the fact that it was still very difficult for me to leave, not being married to this person, not having children with this person, and it was still so difficult, that relationship. So love bombing is a big thing in abusive relationships. And it's pretty much when an abuser uses tokens of affection to shower you with love and make you comfortable with receiving that affection and make you want more of it. So it's like showering you with compliments, making things go too fast, too soon. You know, me 3 weeks in saying, I love you, saying that we should be together. Maybe we should move in together. You know, and my ex, he didn't necessarily do all of those things. But those are signs of love bombing. So especially women, we think that those are signs of, oh, this is it. This is Prince Charming. This is what, this is the one and only. So when someone's popping up at your job or popping up at your house with flowers unannounced and telling you like all day, you're beautiful, you're gorgeous, I want to be with you, we're soulmates, we are destined for one another. And it's to reel you in and get you hooked on that feeling of love. And then when they break you down, whether it's emotionally or verbally or physically, then you're vying for that comfort and affection from the very person who hurt you. It's like you're looking to be put back together by the person who broke you in the first place.
I love that. That is really so clear, Nisha. Thank you for saying that, because, you know, in my relationship, I was the most beautiful. I was the most loved. I got the affection I didn't get as a child. I was showered with love and kisses and hugs and, you know, treats and surprises and phone calls and beautiful things until I wasn't. And it wasn't that it just all starts and all stops. It starts, then the abuse happens, and then that love bombing can restart. Can you talk about the
cycle,
roller coaster, or the cycle?
Yes, definitely. So the cycle of abuse, it's pretty much just as what you said. You have that, it started off with, if you look at the power and control wheel, so you have the tension building phase. So that tension building phase is you're not really sure what's wrong, but you know something is wrong. You're walking on eggshells. The person is upset with you for whatever reason, but you're not really sure what the issue is. Then after the tension building phase, the explosion happens. So the explosion happens, and that's where the incident of assault occurs. So whether that's physical abuse or you're assaulted verbally, sexually, what have you, that's the explosion. So then after that is the reconciliation phase, where this person says, I'm sorry, it will never happen. And, you know, I was just mad. I was just upset. I had a bad day at work. Can you please forgive me? And then you're sharp with the gifts and the love bombing and things like that. So then the honeymoon phase happens, where, okay, all is well. You've forgiven this person. You are back to watching movies, Netflix and chill, and going on dates and dinner and things like that. And then next thing you know, whether it's a day later, a week later, a month later, however, the tension building phase happens again. The explosion phase happens again, reconciliation phase, honeymoon phase, and then it just goes on and on and on in a cycle.
And that's a great explanation of the cycle. Give me an example. We've talked about the attention phase. In your life, what was the explosion phase? Was it verbal abuse, physical abuse? Because in my life, my spouse would drink too much occasionally and, you know, try to run me over with the car, hit me over the head with a lamp while drunk. And I would always excuse it, because so much of our relationship time was the honeymoon phase. We did the honeymoon phase in my prior marriage really well.
This podcast is supported by Focus for Health Foundation. Together, we are in the fight to protect children from abuse. Learn more on our social media platforms with our handle at Focus for Health or by logging onto our website at focusforhealth.org.
So tell me about the explosive phase for you.
So he started off with, I mean, aside from the isolation that started happening gradually and the manipulation. So it would be things like, you know, I only want to spend time with you because it seems like you never want to spend time with me. Don't you like me too? Don't you care about me too? So then it's like, okay, I do care about you. Let me cancel going out with my friends because to prove to you that I care about you. Mm-hmm. So that gave way to verbal abuse, which I didn't recognize at first as verbal abuse because one, I was of the mindset that domestic violence was just, you know, involved bruises and things like that. And then I had this preconceived notion and this misconception rather of what a domestic violence victim is. So I thought it was just some woman cowering in a corner being beaten. So I didn't think that words when he's calling me things like, you know, saying things like, it doesn't take a genius, or did you think that was really bright for you to do? So he wasn't outright calling me stupid at first, which eventually he started doing that. But it was like, you know, what are you dumb? Like, I mean, it's not rocket science, you know, and it's just little belittling things, or telling me that, you know, his last girlfriend did this better than me, or that, you know, my job, I worked at a law firm, so your job, you're not going to get beyond this cubicle, you know, this is where you're going to stay. And it got to a point where this is why your ex left you and the one before that left you. So again, it wasn't like outright name calling yet, but just demeaning and belittling and kind of doing like embarrassing me or making me feel small. So then it eventually gave way to the, I'm a bitch, I'm a dumb bitch, I'm a worthless bitch. Nobody wants me. When I got a second job at a sports bar, so I worked at a law firm by day, and I was like a hostess at a sports bar by night. I remember he called me, he told me I was now going to be a walking STD, you know.
God.
He with that particular job, I remember he showed up at the job and posed as a customer, and I had to wait on him. So my manager didn't know that this was my boyfriend who I hadn't yet really labeled as abusive because it hadn't gotten physical yet. So I'm just, you know, I have to wait on him and he's complaining about the food and the manager's like, that customer's not happy. Humiliating. So, you know, that's that emotional and verbal abuse. And at this point, it started happening more and more where I was just like all the time I was ugly. I was too skinny. He would sit me down and tell me everything that was wrong with me. I remember one Valentine's Day, he told me that he was going to get me proactive because he was tired of seeing my skin all effed up. Like my skin was.
Oh, God. And I just want listeners to know that Nisha is beautiful. You know, really has a brilliant, bright smile. She looks like an actress. She's extremely good looking and beautiful, charming. And so no matter what is hurled at you, you have to understand it's not the truth.
Right.
I'm not sure where it comes from with them. I mean, why do they feel like they need abusers, domestic violence abusers, need to undermine you, make you feel terrible about themselves, lower your self-esteem, tear you down? What's in that for them? I mean,
well, abuse is about power and control. And if I can, I tell anyone when I talk about DV, I said, you know, if they can break you down mentally, the rest is easy. So it got to a point where, and he played on my weaknesses. So, and because it wasn't always bad, because we had good times too, we had inside jokes, we had really fun dates. So when you either expect abusive relationships to be all bad, but when it's combined with good times, then you're really wrestling with those mixed emotions within yourself. So you're really vying for those good times. And when you're in an abusive relationship, you don't necessarily want the relationship to end, You want the abuse,
to end.
And there's a difference.
Right.
So I just wanted the good boyfriend. So I thought, okay, maybe if I do more of this and less of that, maybe if I clear my skin up, or maybe if I had a bigger butt or bigger breast, or if my teeth were whiter, or if I had a better job, or if my credit was better, just all these different
things. My credit was better.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's crazy. It's like, you know, who is he? The Bank of America? Just, you know, my credit needs like to be better. Maybe my car needs to be newer. Maybe my, you know, my social media followers need to be more people commenting. I mean, you're so right. And so what you're saying is interesting, because people feel like domestic violence or child sexual abuse only happens to people impoverished, or only happens to people of color or Latinx, but it happens to rich people in wealthy communities, as demonstrated by the TV show Big Little Lies that starred Nicole Kidman, Laura Dern, Reese Witherspoon, you know, Lenny Kravitz's daughter, Zoe Kravitz. I mean, you know, you see this very wealthy, successful, beautiful white woman that has this gorgeous house on the beach. They look extremely wealthy in Northern California, part of the Silicon Valley. And she is struggling with the domestic violence that he is perpetrating, that she cannot tell any members of her community. She cannot come clean, because I see in wealthy communities, whether they're white or communities of color, a different form of domestic abuse. Like, I'll go into the market and see a child all dressed up perfect, like a little angel or fairy with a wand and a tutu and all that. And the mother looks frightened, like she's going to pick the wrong piece of meat, or she's not going to get the perfect salad, or the daughter's going to go home and tell daddy, mommy did this in the market. She looked enslaved. She looked battered, but her skin wasn't beaten up, but her head was down, her eyes were down. And I felt sorry for her. She looked afraid to be in the market. Who's afraid to be in a supermarket? And it looked like the kids had all the power over her. Like, you know, she was constantly saying to her daughter, you're sure this is what you want? Are you happy? Can I buy you this? I mean, really? So the question is, people and us included, like when it happened in my relationship, it took me years to call it domestic violence. I thought it was just stress and tension, and people had problems, and I made mistakes. I had a big mouth. I was pushing. I should have done this. I never questioned my credit, but I did question. I just did a TV show. Did I not look right? Did I not sound right? We were with friends. Did I embarrass? It was like walking on eggshells. And the thing that one of my friends finally said to me is, okay, it's 11 o'clock. We were eating dinner and barbecuing, a good girlfriend of mine. And she said, you shouldn't have to be home at 11 o'clock when they get home. What the hell is that about?
Right.
For me, it was normal. I thought this person cared so much about me that they wanted to make sure I was safe and at home at a certain time. And she said to me, you're in an abusive relationship. I think you need to call a therapist. I'm worried about you. If it hadn't been for my dearest friend, I'm not sure. I probably would have gotten run over by the car on some drunken night where the person was furious with me over, I can't even tell you what. Nisha, I don't know what they were so mad about. I only knew it was my fault. I only knew I spent a lot of time in a hotel, and I had a bag packed in my car with money and a credit card at all times. And I was a working lawyer making my own money with my own ability, career. I was in the newspapers. I was covered by the media, and I had a bag packed in my car. So what the hell does that say? You know, and I thought it was normal. I called it an earthquake kit because I live in California. But when I noticed, I kept going to the same Japanese hotel nearby because I knew this person wouldn't know to look for me there. And I was there a lot.
Yeah.
So, but I must be an idiot, Nisha. I must be a frigging idiot to not. And I was working cases on child sexual abuse. I was helping women get out of violent relationships, but I never looked in the mirror and said, hey, that's me too.
And we often don't. I mean, I grew up again, I just had this misconception about what domestic violence was. My sisters are strong women. My mother's the strongest woman I know. And I used to think, that it meant that you were weak. I mean, I remember being 20, 21 years old and seeing a friend get assaulted by her boyfriend in front of me, and me and my boyfriend at the time, I remember him telling me it's none of our business. And right. I remember talking to her the next day and saying, why don't you just leave?
Exactly.
And that's the question, you know, that I hate to hear now, but at that time, and being 22 years old, and I didn't get into my abusive relationship until I was 26. So I just didn't know. And it's ignorance, and it's putting that onus on the victim instead of the abuser, instead of saying, why are you hitting her? Why are you hitting him? We put it on the victim as if it's their fault.
Like, why are you putting up with it? Why don't you leave? You're so right. It's whether it's sexual abuse, domestic violence,
right,
always get the blame. It's never why is he raping you? It's like, how did you let yourself be raped? What were you wearing?
Right. What were you wearing?
Why
did you go to his apartment?
Why did you, go to this bar and have two drinks? Well, why did he take advantage of a woman that had had two drinks? And so in your situation, like my friend said to me, I will help you get out if you need money. I'll send it to you. I'll make calls for you. I don't feel good with you staying there. And this person was friends with both of us. And she never told me what to do in life. She never really advised me. So when she said it, I thought something's really wrong here. So for you, did yours ever escalate to physical violence or no?
It did. So what happened was, at this point, I had been in an abusive, verbally, emotionally, psychologically, abusive relationship for about 3 years at this point. And at this point, so I'm completely a shell of myself, I'm depressed. I'm not recognizing that it's depression. My self-esteem is shot. I hate looking in the mirror, and my days just consist of going to work, being mom, and just being in this toxic relationship. So at the same time, I started going through financial struggles, and I wound up losing my home.
Oh no.
Financial struggles.
Oh, that's terrible.
I sent my children to live with their dad, my daughter's father, who's in the area. And for 9 months, they lived with him. And so my days consisted of getting up in the morning, going to his house, seeing the kids off for school, making sure they ate breakfast, going to work, working throughout the day. And at the time, I worked for Bank of America in the loan modification department. And I remember sometimes I would go in the bathroom and cry right around 5 p.m. because I would hear people making excited about dinner, going to check on the crock pot, watch their favorite show. And I'm close with my family, but I was so broken and so humiliated at the place where I was in life. I didn't want to ask them for help. So
because you felt ashamed, right?
I was ashamed.
I was ashamed too. I felt, me who should have known better, I was educated. I studied this, I litigated it. And even I had it in my own home, and a friend had to shake me and go, get out.
Yeah. Right.
So women, it's not that you're not smart. It's not that, I think it's denial. I think you also love this abuser. I can't say I didn't love them. I still did.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't and it wasn't all the time. There would be wonderful times. And so you finished with your day. So you were at work, you were working for Bank of America loan modification. You were going to your children's house, putting them to bed, and then where were you living when you lost your house?
So I would just, for a little bit, I was at a friend's, I would sleep on her couch. And then, every weekend I would bring my kids there and we would stay there for the weekend. And then, that was just for temporarily. So then I would couch hop. I was at another friend's on her couch. I was in a friend's garage. I remember it wasn't insulated, so it was really amazing. But she tried to give me my own space, and it was couch and TV and stuff in there. It was just cold. There were a couple nights in my car. Red Roof Inn became my best friend. So I was always at Red Roof Inn. But this whole time I'm in this abusive relationship that I'm not recognizing as abusive because he hadn't put his hands on me yet. I just knew it didn't feel good. I thought he was an asshole. I thought he was a jerk a lot of times, but I thought he was great a lot of times too. So I just thought this was the up and downs of relationships.
Right.
So he, this whole time, thought that I was staying at a girlfriend's house. He did not know I was couch hopping and sleeping here and sleeping there, because the accusations that would come as a result, I just couldn't deal with. So one day he said to me, he said, you know, instead of staying at your friend's house and paying her rent, why don't you just come here and live for free until you get yourself together? Mm-hmm. And my goal was, I said, well, okay. One, because I was tired of couch hopping and feeling like a burden. Two, I thought that if we moved together, maybe things, you know,
would work out, like he, like if his insecurities would go away, or you could love him enough to make him feel less insecure.
Right. And most importantly, if I can stop spending money at hotels, just to sleep there for 5 hours and get up in the morning and go see my kids and then go to work, then go see the kids after work, then go to the hotel at 10 o'clock at night, paying hundreds, $100+ a night. I said, I need to save my money and I need to get a house so I can get my kids back. So I said, yes.
Yeah.
And that's when I moved in, that's when the physical abuse started.
And so, I mean, so, and did he drink or smoke weed or so we can't even blame substances on it, right?
No, he did not.
It happen right away? And then I'm going to jump to something pretty soon, but did he hit you? Did he choke you? I don't mean to get you into terrible trauma, but just give me a little bit of idea of what physical abuse sounds like. I know I got hit over the head with lamps, run over, shaken by the neck, pulled by my hair.
And you just say, you can't get me in trouble because I'm very open and there's nothing to do or say that. So I'm very open. So,
and by the way, this is the first time I've ever talked about this. So thank you for allowing me to do that.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the first time he assaulted me, I came home late from work and he thought I was somewhere where I wasn't. And really, I just got off work late. Traffic. And then by the time I got the kids and everything in order, got and came to his house, it just was later than normal. So, but it was still like maybe before 9 o'clock even. So he was accusing me of going, like being out and calling me a whore and telling me I was a slut and I was out sleeping around and doing all these things. So at this point, the verbal and emotional abuse had been going on for years and I was just tired of it. Mm-hmm. We were sitting, he was sitting back against the bed, like, so his back was against the headboard or the wall rather. And I was on the edge of the bed and I just said, you know, forget this, I'm done. And I reached down to pick up my purse, which was on the floor between the bed and the wall. And when I picked up my purse and kind of turned around to face him, he had a pillow and he hauled off and he slapped me so hard with this pillow that I fell off the bed. And then I know the pillow, it was more of a pride thing. So the pillow didn't necessarily hurt. He did it with enough force that I fell into the space of the floor and between the bed and the wall. But it was the fact that it had got to this point. So I'm jumping up. And again, Sherry, I'm from Jersey. So I like squared up. And
he squared up. Those fists came up and like, you want to rumble here?
Yeah. Like you. Okay.
But you're never going to be able to take on a guy bigger, stronger, more muscled. You don't have a chance. You better have, you know, something much more serious and then be prepared to go to jail for using excessive force.
Right. So, and the thing when physical abuse, like again,
you squared up.
It escalates. And if you've been strangled by your partner, you're 10 times more likely to be killed by that person. Mm-hmm. In like first instances of abuse, I don't really hear of too many who get strangled right away. Like in first instance of abuse.
That's right.
He pushed, he punched, he kicked, he choked, and what made him stop was he was strangling me. And I remember thinking that, wow, I'm going to die. In this space between his wall and his bed, nobody knows where I am. Nobody knows where I am.
Right.
Just fading in and out of consciousness to where the dots, like, and my mouth was bleeding and his hands just kind of, he let go because and he was just on top of me, and he let go, and he just backed up, and I jumped up, and I was just gagging and gasping, and I grabbed my purse, and I ran out to my car, and he ran out after me, and I was crying, and he was crying, and we're both crying, and he's saying he's sorry, and just please come back. And I went back because I
didn't have- did go back. How did you finally leave? Because we got therapy, actually, where we lived apart, and then we each received therapy, and then we got couples therapy, and things really calmed down after that. I mean, I learned to talk differently, but I never recognized it for what it was. I'm not sure I would have or should have stayed that whole time, even with therapy. Things got better, but it was like walking on eggshells a lot of the time. But so what made you finally leave? And then I want you to set this clip up we're going to go to. So what was the final straw for you? So was he ever abusive to your children? Did he meet your children?
No. And that's the funny thing. We dated for almost pretty much just about 5 years. And he never met my kids. I mean, and he's a father as well. So we had seen each other's children maybe in passing, but I had never said, hi, this is, you know, hey, kids, this is such and such, and this is such and such, and this is mommy's friend. I mean, I just never
did. And that's interesting because you were together almost 5 years, I think you said, and that you never wanted to introduce them to your children should have been a huge red flag.
Right.
I think you were protecting your kids. You don't want them to get attached to him and maybe be harmed by him. You tell me. I'm just saying. I mean, I'm speaking for you, and I shouldn't. You tell
me. Oh, no, it's okay. I was just, I mean, I had never had anyone around my children other than, you know, my son. So my son has a different father. So it was like my son's father. And then when my daughter's father and we broke up, but he had been the only other person that had been around my son and our daughter. So I was protecting them in that sense. But then also once I started seeing how, I guess underlying deep down, I knew what kind of person he was. And I just didn't my kids to that. And even not exposing my kids to meeting him or to the abuse, my son years later told me that he knew something was wrong. So even though he was never around him, my daughter was never around him, my son still knew. He still would hear me crying at night. He said he's still on the phone arguing. He still knew that I was a completely different person than the woman that I am today.
And that is so interesting because you can never really hide it from family.
Correct. You can't.
From children. And kids are really smart. They're really tuned into you and they love you. And I just think that women think they're protecting their kids by taking punches. They're not.
And they know more than we think they do.
They do no more. So I'd like you to set up this clip that's on your website that I'm going to play. And I want to warn everybody, it's a trigger warning. This is a very, very intense 911 call. So Nisha, set this clip up for me. You use this on your site. It's a six-year-old child. What's happening? And then I'll play it.
So this is a call. It's called Lisa's call, or Lisa's 911 call. And this is actually a call I heard in a domestic violence training class, domestic violence awareness and advocacy training class that I took some years ago. And it's based in the early 1990s. And it's a six-year-old who is calling 911 as her mother is being abused by her stepfather. And it was just really powerful. I mean, everyone in the training class, and it's used often. So I just thought that I would share it as well.
And I'm going to play a clip because this really upset me, but also helped me understand that if you're in an abusive relationship and you have children, this is how it affects your children as well. So here we go with Lisa's call. But again, if you're in the car listening to this podcast with kids, you might either want to mute the sound, put your headphones on, or listen later. If you're home, this is a trigger warning. It's definitely triggering. So here we go. Mommy. Wow. So, Nisha, what do you want to say about that? Oh, my God. Every time I hear that, it just breaks me apart.
Yeah. Was that the first time you had heard it? When
it's like the third time I've heard it, and I'm still shattered by it.
Yeah. I mean, had you heard it before seeing it on my website, or had you heard of the call?
I heard it through you sending us the clip.
Oh, wow. Oh,
you educated me. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And even our producers were really, really shattered by this clip. I mean,
yeah.
Oh,
it's heartbreaking. Boy. It's heartbreaking. And then just doing the work that I do, not just with my nonprofit, but having worked in prosecutors' offices and even the police department. And you hear when you're in a position to sit in court and hear 911 calls replayed. You know, there's so many little Lisas out there and little boys out there who are making calls like this or who want to find the courage to make calls like this. And it's just so heartbreaking. And I know it's triggering. And I remember playing it for people before and they wanted to turn it off. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, little Lisa couldn't turn it off.
Exactly.
So this is, we have to face it. This is, domestic violence isn't pretty. And this is why we need to speak up. This is why we need to stand up. And this is why we need to bring awareness, because this is what's happening behind closed doors.
Exactly. So let me ask you something. If someone is suffering from domestic abuse, you talk about 7 things they need to do right now. Can you walk us through those 7 things? And the first one is, you know,
oh, you're talking about that Essence interview that I did.
Okay. I did. Yes. We do our homework over here. We really take a deep dive so that we are prepared for amazing guests like you. So talk about the 7 things you talked about.
I told them a lot. So I'm like, what 7 did they say? I know.
Well,
one
first you said that it's that people have to know it's not their fault.
Right. It's not their fault. Right. You have to know that you don't deserve this and that mm-hmm. you don't have to function in dysfunction. And I know I kind of skipped past a question you asked before. What gave me the courage to leave is,
yes.
or what made me leave is when this was an interracial relationship and he called my mother and my sisters the N-word. and during an argument. So that was the catalyst for me. And, you know, for me, it was like, okay, it's one thing if you belittle me, but to call the women I love most something so horrific, nigger, you know, like, I was just like, I can't do it anymore. So, and
what race was he?
White. Mm. He was white. And this was after he had gone to counseling. This is after,
right.
You know, yep. So the last time he put his hands on me was March of 2012, but I didn't leave until late that year, beginning of the year after. So I tell people, I said, just because March was the last time he put his hands on me, wasn't the last time he abused me. And, you know,
correct.
The light bulb goes off. And I said, you know, it was still the control of the gaslighting, the manipulation. So when he did that, that was it for me. I said, I cannot do this anymore. So you all have you're done, and then you're done, like you're finished. And you just have to get to a point where you're like, I don't deserve this. Talk to someone that you trust, you know, mm-hmm. their resources. So whether you ask someone that you trust to help you find resources, you know, whether it's your local domestic violence crisis support agency, whether it's the National Domestic Violence Hotline, you know, you can help create, do a safety plan. So advocates within your local agency or within the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is 1-800-799-7233, by the way, just to throw that out there.
Thank you.
Hotline. You're welcome. So 1-800-799-SAFE, and SAFE is the number 7233. But if you call and you make a safety plan, maybe you have to start putting money away, like inconspicuously, like having a friend hold it, or having a bank account that they won't find out about, or having a family member having a bank account that they won't find out about, you know, making copies of important paperwork like health, you know, health records and divorce papers or marriage certificate or protection orders, birth certificate, social security card, things like that.
Passports, because if you run and your important paperwork's left at your abuser's, you have no identity to prove yourself anywhere.
Right. I can't name how many survivors I've talked to where the abuser took their driver's license, their birth certificate, their social security card, their bank cards. How do you start over? With nothing, you can't go into the bank and say, this is who I am. I need to take the money out so I can get a train ticket to get out of here, or else I'll get killed. You have no idea to do that. So when they take those things from you, that's the ultimate, yet another ultimate power control move.
Well, here's what's interesting. Meghan Markle did an interview with Oprah last night on,
I was watching
one
it.
Of the first things that she said is that the palace, Buckingham Palace, took away her driver's license, her passport, all of her identifying information, so that she's basically a identity prisoner. I mean, right. She's famous, and maybe she has a lot of help, and maybe people will help her. But when you're in a situation where you're nearly in prison and identityless, I never understood how critical it is to be able to have a credit card, passport, driver's license, social security card, the ability to prove your identity to start your own life.
Right.
And so that is super important, that you need to copy those documents and keep them in a safe place. Right. I also recommend you get a protective order. Right. I recommend you document the abuse. Person that referred you to us is Sherry Curticall, who's from Victims Voice. And she says they will help you document the abuse that has been accepted by courts all over the country, because it's encoded in a special way. She says, leave, have a safety plan, call 911. But also, you need to set aside resources. You can't just leave with $1.25 in your pocket, especially if you have two children. They need milk and eggs and orange juice and cereal and, you know, meat and whatever. So you do need to start keeping money aside. I mean, I even, as a successful woman, kept money in that getaway bag. Because if I ran out without my purse, or my purse was taken by my domestic abuser, I had nothing, no credit cards. I couldn't check into a hotel. I was not about to sleep in my car. One time, the last time it happened, I ran away, left my briefcase at home, and had a huge hearing the next day, and could never get back in the house to get my cross-examination, my direct examination, all of my notes. because I ran without my briefcase and I said, that's it. Right. Enough.
Right.
And there is the point of enough. And really, Nisha, our enoughs as women and survivors of domestic violence is way too generous.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it takes the average victim 7 attempts to leave before they leave for good. So
wow.
it doesn't mean that when you leave seven times, they could have been assaulted 5 times before making the first attempt, you know,
or you're murdered. I know that the time that OJ allegedly killed Nicole Simpson was when she had finally said enough and really left.
Right.
So the most dangerous time for domestic abuse survivors is when you're getting ready to leave.
Right.
And when you left, I was representing a domestic abuse survivor in a courtroom. And as we stepped out of the elevator, her abuser came off that floor, slashed her neck from bone to bone, murdered her right there coming out of the elevator when we were getting a final dissolution. In front of me, in front of the bailiffs, in front of, there was blood everywhere. And she was on her last steps to get out.
Sherry, oh my God.
I mean, you know, this is, we're not playing here, everybody. This isn't just a little, you know, women think domestic violence. Why don't you leave? Why don't you tell? Why don't you get out? It's always blamed on us. Right. We should have done something different with our abusers. And this is our fault that we haven't. Every single day, a man will say to me, why didn't she leave? And I will say to him, why didn't he stop abusing her? Why didn't the police do anything? Why weren't there better laws in place for her to help her? So let me mention one final thing. You talk about stealthing, and I wanted you to address that just for a second, because there's a new law in California aimed at stealthing. Tell us what stealthing is.
So it's when the abuser, generally the male, uses manipulation. He purposely removes a condom.
Mm-hmm.
Sex, even though the victim may have indicated that she did not want the condom removed, did not want to have unprotected sex. So they will do it quite like inconspicuously, or do something like poke holes in it or something along those lines, for the purpose of whether it's to impregnate the victim. You know, I know a survivor, her abuser kept her pregnant. She was probably for 12 years in a row. You know,
and, I mean, a woman that is pregnant for 12 years in a row can't get out. She can't get away.
Right.
She is there permanently. She can't feed her kids. How do you run with 5 kids or 6 kids or 2 kids or 1 child or 12? I mean, I didn't think she was pregnant for 12 years, but oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a form of control to keep a woman.
Yeah.
We call it barefoot and pregnant because.
Yeah.
Look at me, I was single. I was a professional. I had friends. I had resources. Can you imagine if I had 2 children or 1 child, or if you, Nisha, had him, you were living with him and your children?
Right.
I'm not sure you would have ever gotten out alive.
It would have been very difficult.
Very difficult.
So many, and so the barriers would have been much more.
Oh, so California is working on a piece of legislation right now. They might have already passed it, that makes stealthing, which is removing a condom, interfering with a condom, poking holes in a condom, a form of sexual abuse and sexual assault. And that's a good point. So nationwide. So I'm going to end this interview with the one question that I ask every guest, which is if you are talking to a victim of domestic violence, if there was one thing you could give her or him to help them on their healing journey, what would it be?
I would let them know that there is a way out and they have the power to take the first step towards that freedom.
And there's help out there.
And there's help. I mean, there's help.
And then if you could take one thing away to alleviate the pain of domestic violence victims, what would that be? If you could take something away that alleviates pain, what would you take away to stop the pain?
If I had the power to take away the judgment of society for people who ask for help, because I just remember being that person asking for help and people making me feel small for even doing that, or like my fear didn't matter or didn't matter enough. I would take that away, because I think that if people knew that they could get help without judgment and that they could get real help, they would be more likely to extend their hand out. But that fear of judgment and that fear of being shunned, it keeps you in that darkness that you're trying to escape from.
And that's beautiful. And part of what you're talking about is victim blaming. Yes. And I don't think we as a culture really understand how paralyzing victim blaming is. It keeps the victim glued in place. It keeps a sexual assault victim, a domestic violence victim, a physical abuse victim, a child abuse victim glued and trapped forever. So, you know, understand us better and understand that we need you to love us and help us get out. And so we have learned so much from you today. You're wonderful. If our listeners would like to get in touch with you, please tell us the best way that they can support your organization grow or get in touch with you. If they are a victim of domestic violence, give me a plug here.
Thank you so much. So our website is www.growfoundationva.org. And that's VA as in Virginia. And if you go to the Contact Grow page, you'll see all of our contact information, phone numbers, emails, social media links. We have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I even got a TikTok I got a TikTok specifically for the purpose of bringing awareness to domestic violence. And that is under @ Nisha's Voice. So just thank you, Sherry, so, so much for having me and your producers and just bringing this much needed awareness. Whenever you need me, if you want me to come back, I will definitely do so.
And we would love to have you back, because you've got a wonderful story and you've got so much to share and you have a good heart, and your compassion and non-judgment allowed me to open up to you.
Thank you.
And share with you. Yeah.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you. I never identified myself as that until I started talking to you, actually.
Wow.
So you are a mover and a shaker.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm really humbled by that.
No, I'm humbled by you. So thank you for joining us. Honestly, love you. And we will definitely have you back.
Love you guys too. I'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is supported by Focus for Health Foundation. Together, we are in the fight to protect children from abuse. Learn more on our social media platforms with our handle @FocusForHealth or by logging onto our website @FocusForHealth.org.
Thank you. Stay safe and know that I love you. Roar with Sherry, All Things Justice for Women and Survivors, is hosted by me, Sherry Kearney. It is executive produced by Natasha Nelson, produced by Joe Kalk, sound engineer, the awesome Ronan Rosner, and music by the amazing Sharon Gittow. We'd love to hear from you. Please follow us on our social media @RoarAsOne and @SherryKearney, and go to our website, roarasone.org. And as you know, all the Roar with Sherry podcasts have episode pages on roarasone.org, and we will give you all the guests and all our social media handles on the website, roarasone.org. Roar as One, Inc. owns the copyright in and to all content in and transcripts of the Roar with Sherry, All Things Justice for Women and Survivors podcast, with all rights reserved, including right of publicity. The nonprofit Roar as One is providing this podcast as a public service, but it is neither a legal interpretation or a statement of policy. Reference to any specific guest, product, or opinion by the host does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by Roar as One, Sherry Kearney Legal Education, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent.